Hello, you're listening to On The Point, the news collective show formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Maddie Delplain.
And I'm Grace Jenkins. It's Saturday, February 6th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus, on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today we're talking with Mark Hayden with MAPS Canada, who is also an adjunct professor in the School of Population and Public Health at UBC. He gives us a rundown of some of what's been happening in the world of psychedelic research.
We also speak to Namjeet, a volunteer at the Indian Farmers protest that occurred in front of the Vancouver Art Gallery at the end of January.
But first, did you know it's Fun Drive season, our annual fundraising event? Throughout the show, we'll be taking turns sharing our experiences at CITR and why you should donate to support a good cause. I'm going to go first. I joined the News Collective in my first year at UBC. It's been a space where student journalists can get practical hands-on training with audio equipment and software, and I've learned a lot during my time here. We put out independent and local news here at On The Point, so think of it as investing into the future of journalism. If you're interested in helping out, head over to citr.ca/donate. And if you do donate, make sure you put the News Collective as the inspiration from the drop-down menu. Anyway, back to news. Maddie, so tell me about your interview with Mark Hayden.
Okay, so to set this up a little bit, I had the opportunity to speak with Mark Hayden, who is an adjunct professor at UBC with the School of Population and Public Health, and he's also the executive director of MAPS Canada, or the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. There is so much going on in this field right now, especially recently, so I had a lot of questions for him. But just for a bit of background, speaking very generally, there's essentially been a growing heap of research that has shown the benefits of using different forms of psychedelics under certain conditions to treat a number of ailments, from trauma to depression and anxiety to addiction.
Sounds interesting. What are MAPS doing, though?
Okay, so MAPS Canada is currently sponsoring phase 3 trials looking at the use of MDMA to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. There's also a lot happening in the world of psychedelic research, and it all raises a lot of interesting questions. So, like, what would the use of psychedelic-assisted therapies in a clinical setting look like? And what might this look like from a legalization standpoint? In any case, Mr. Hayden generously gave me nearly an hour of his time to address some of my many questions about this work. But the part of the interview that you're about to hear deals largely with the legalization of psychedelics and what we should think about from, like, a policy rollout and regulation standpoint. As I'd mentioned, Mr. Hayden has a background in public health, so a lot of what we go over is based on work that he's been doing for decades. Anyways, I hope you all enjoy it.
Let's take a listen.
Yeah, so I guess just to start off, I've sort of gotten the feeling that psychedelics are sort of everywhere right now, especially like in BC, and as MAPS Canada says, you know, they're going through a bit of a renaissance at the moment. What do you think is sort of like the most likely path to legalization at this point? And are you optimistic that that's something that we can look forward to happening soon?
Yes, and I'll give you the complex answer to your question because there are multiple tracks. So track number one is the phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials, which is what the MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for post-traumatic stress disorder is, and the psilocybin for depression and end-of-life anxiety is. So medicalizing them and getting a DIN number and then having them on prescription in the context of therapy is one track of legalization. But it's more complicated than that, because a second track, so cannabis, you are aware that cannabis was legalized in Canada, not because it was medicalized, but because public opinion changed over the decades. And when it reached 56% of Canadians, Justin Trudeau said he wanted to legalize cannabis because he was a politician who read the polls. And he did very well through the process. So popular opinion is a second route of legalization. And as we do all of our different clinical trials, it gets into the media and the media positively reports us. So far, the media has been very gracious with us of actually just reporting the truth, which is kind of remarkable sometimes. Being an old advocate of drug policy reform and watching the media not do that over many decades, but nevertheless. So popular opinion is the second one. The third way of them becoming legalized is what just happened in the States is Oregon went through a polling initiative that produced legal access to psilocybin in the context of open access as opposed to therapy. It wasn't associated with a diagnosis. So anybody in Oregon will be able to access the psilocybin experience from a legal trained guide without the context of a diagnosis. That's track number three. And track number four is decriminalization. Now, decriminalization means you can't get charged with the product, with possession or sales. I mean, it depends how decriminalization is worded, but it means withdrawing the law, but it doesn't specify how it could be legalized. But decrim is a type of legalization, one could say. I'm pushing the words a little bit there. But so there's really four different tracks and they all kind of work together as, you know, as we do our stage one, two, and three clinical trials, it changes popular opinion. As popular opinion changes, oh, and then there's the, actually there's two more I want to throw on the pile here. Okay, so there's section, in Canada, there's the section 56 exemptions that are happening for psilocybin. And then there's the special access process that we are working with to have access to parallel to our phase three study. So that's actually six different vehicles of legalization. And they all work together. As popular opinion changes, it's less threatening for bureaucrats to be more evidence-based. And I think the frequent and positive media attention to it allowed the bureaucrats to approve psilocybin access. And the media was very friendly when they did. And it's been a positive experience. And now I think 23 or something like 23 people have been approved end of life. You know, people who are dying are allowed to have psilocybin experiences, which actually just makes sense. If you're allowed to kill yourself, if the MAID process exists, if you're allowed to die, you should be allowed to try.
So I'm curious, what do you see as sort of the timeline for something like psychedelic assisted therapies in sort of a clinical setting becoming available to the general public?
Well, soon. Like we're actually, I believe, you know, months away, not years away. So the reason why is the federal government, Health Canada, has asked for a public consultation around the special access program. And so we believe that public consultation will be positive. And therefore, we're going to start rolling out a parallel process to the phase three study starting in the spring.
So I've always been particularly interested in the potentials for psychedelic therapies and the use of addiction treatment. How far out do you think that we are from potentially being able to introduce psychedelics in more of a rehabilitation sort of a setting?
Well, if the person is also diagnosed with PTSD, it could happen fairly quickly. In fact, I assume that's going to happen quickly. I'm now in the process of collecting names of people that would be trained and then be able to access them outside of our research within the context of the special access program. And there's certainly one residential treatment center that is working quite closely with me to get their staff trained. So it's not an addictions treatment center. It's more of a generic treatment center. So it's a trauma treatment center is what it is. And they're keenly interested in this, and it's the perfect location. It's the perfect population. It's the perfect environment. And they just happen to be set up to do psychedelic work in terms of the facility. There are certain building requirements that you need to do psychedelic work. And so I think it'll happen sooner rather than later.
So sort of switching gears here, on sort of the opposite end of the spectrum, I've heard quite a bit of buzz recently, like particularly in Vancouver, around microdosing psilocybin. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but to my understanding, a lot of the research around the benefits of microdosing are comparably kind of shaky compared to, say, like the research that's behind like macrodosing and bigger psychedelic experiences. Could you sort of What's your take on this? Like, could you maybe break down a little bit for me whether or not you see that there are any real benefits from something like microdosing?
So it's interesting you said microdosing psilocybin. One of the most popular drugs being microdosed today is actually LSD. It's two-thirds. Okay. Yeah, the research that I get was 900 respondents in Thomas Anderson and Rodenberg Tanker's survey. And in that survey, which was pretty massive, they said the respondents to that survey, two-thirds of them were LSD, one-third was psilocybin. So yes, the anecdotal evidence is pretty consistent that people like it, but there's no clinical trial research to date. And so we actually don't know. It's reasonable to assume that a psychedelic will have a strong, for want of a better term, placebo response. If you think about what a placebo is something you give somebody something and you say, this will have a strong effect. This may have a strong effect on you. And then people do have the strong effect. So, you know, the mind has a huge control over, and belief systems have huge control over everything from positive mood to ability to focus, and all the things that people claim are useful when they take a microdose are also possibly available through just the placebo response. So we don't know. The research is not there with microdosing. And the best that we can say is that it may help sort of symptom management, but there's no argument that it actually is treatment. You know, it's not going to cure somebody in the same way that a macrodose can.
So my understanding also with microdosing is it, like, aside from the, I guess, sort of lack of evidence behind its effectiveness, is like, I get sort of the sensation that it's taking something that to be effective wouldn't necessarily require multiple doses or prolonged use, and kind of making it more marketable, making it more profitable. I don't know if that suspicion is accurate, but has that been sort of, is that the impression that you've gotten from, I guess, businesses that are so sort of focusing more on like a microdosing model?
Pharmaceutical companies really like drugs that people take for long periods of time and that don't cure you. That's their ideal business model. You get somebody onto something and they take it for decades and they never get healed. And that's the microdosing model. The macrodosing model is a very, very short engagement. You know, I mean, if you think about most of the research, it either gives one, two, or three experiences. I don't know of any research that gives more than three. That's very small. That's a very, very small amount of a drug to take.
I imagine that's something that may have complicated sort of the funding aspect of a lot of this research for some time, no?
Well, the funding is really challenging, you know, because we rely on donations. And so it's people who see the benefit and would like to see it, psychedelics available. So we're really funded by, if I think about our different folks who show up and offer us donations, there are people who are impacted by some of the things that we can treat, some of the diagnoses that we can treat. I mean, you know, somebody who has, for example, eating disorders or post-traumatic stress disorders in their family and have tried various treatments and know that they don't work, has a huge vested interest in supporting us financially. But there's also, I mean, we have a lot of people who just really enjoy psychedelics and they think they're great. And they see that medicalizing them is the way to eventually have wider access. I mean, if you're interested, I like the discussion of what do we do after we medicalize them. And if you're interested, I have two hats, or I have many hats, but one of them my MAPS Canada hat on, but I also have a public health hat where I discuss and publish articles on post-prohibition models for the regulation and control of all currently illegal drugs based on different sort of public health principles. And so if you apply public health principles to psychedelic legalization, what model do you come up with? And I have a paper, you can download it, it's free. If you just Google the paper, it's called A Public Health Approach, the Regulation and Control of Psychedelics under my name. And I advocate for two streams. One stream is the medicalized stream, or the payment stream, the commercialized stream. So if somebody wants to provide the service, they can, and you know, given appropriate training, and they can charge for the service, and they are accountable to a professional body so that people can complain about them. If they do something wrong, there's an oversight body. So if you're going to pay for something, you should have the right to complain about the receiver service you received. So that's one stream. But the other stream is just access. And so to be completely blunt, I took years to write the paper because I was really developing my own eyes, my own ideas around this. And I would present that idea that I just said to you at a number of different conferences. And I would always get people challenging me. And essentially somebody would stand up at the back and say, what I do under the influence of a psychedelic with my partner, I do not want supervised. And I understand that. So it's reasonable if you're talking about outside of diagnoses, if you're talking about healthy relationships, if you want a relationship to be improved, that's probably something you don't want supervised. So the idea of access is also important. So the second stream that I propose is that people should be allowed to purchase them. But then it's not quite that simple, because if you look at today, if you go into Erowid, for example, and you look at what goes wrong with psychedelic use, it's pretty consistent that it's lack of supervision and it's lack of understanding of how to do setting, safety, and dosage issues. So people need to be trained. So I propose a two-weekend course. And the weekend number one is understanding what is set. You know, that's the expectations and what you bring to the experience of how you're thinking and feeling in the moment. What is setting? Setting is the environment you take it in. What does dosage mean? You know, 100 mics of LSD is completely different from 1,000 mics of LSD. And if you don't know the difference, you got a problem. And, you know, safety issues generally, how do you structure safety? So dosage and safety issues would be the first weekend. It would be knowledge. And the second weekend would be actually having an experience from somebody that's a trained professional who's good at running people through a first experience. And you demonstrate how a psychedelic experience can be managed skillfully. And you know, you assess people, you set them up for the experience, you have the experience and you debrief and the whole thing. And then so after the end of two weekends, you then have to answer some questions. You should know the difference between 1 gram and 5 grams of dry cubensis mushrooms. If you don't know the difference, you should fail the test. You should know what set and setting means. You should know how long the various molecules last for in your system and how long you need to be managing it. And you know, can you drive home at the end of 4 hours? Well, probably not. So some really basic things. And if you pass that test, you'd be granted a license or a card that would allow you to walk into a store and purchase psychedelics for, you know, a small amount, not a kilo of LSD, but enough to use for yourself and a few friends for a few weeks.
So you sort of touched on this briefly before in one of your other responses, but I'm just curious, you know, moving forward with different types of psychedelic therapies and things like that, like, you know, there's this sort of acknowledgement that various indigenous communities have used different substances like psilocybin or ayahuasca in forms of traditional medicines for forever, essentially. How do we sort of, moving forward with this, make sure that we're navigating this territory appropriately so that we're not being effectively culturally appropriative and that we are mindful and respectful of the fact that these are, you know, tied very closely with a lot of cultural traditions of groups that often experience marginalization in our societies?
Well, I could completely envision, you know, gazing into my crystal ball and fantasizing about 20 years from now. It would make sense to me that trained ayahuasqueros, who are quite frankly trained through the traditional use of ayahuasca, be the ones that provide ayahuasca. And how that works, you know, is I in my model that I have of paid professionals, I'm assuming that ayahuasqueros will want to be paid. So the paid professional, then you need to have the college oversight of the paid professionals, including indigenous people. So on that college board, you would have ayahuasqueros, you would have peyote folks, You would have curanderos, and you would have people who are treatment for PTSD folks and the doctors. And then they would all get together and they would be challenged with, how do you regulate this? And my belief is they would come up with something like, you know, ayahuascaros get to provide ayahuasca. And they go through the traditional training that ayahuascaros have always gone through. Curanderos provide psilocybin mushrooms in the context of psilocybin mushroom rituals coming out of Mexico, and they get trained by curanderos, that tradition. Peyote people have been trained through peyote tradition. So all of those would continue to exist, and they would be, their own traditions would be honored. Now, probably some non-Indigenous folks would become interested in that and want to be trained. And then it would be up to that board and that group to say who could be trained and who can't. I mean, you may want to have, in one example, you may want to have, you know, master's level trained counselors for the PTSD folks. And with the ayahuascaros, you may want to have whatever. So it's really up to that board to come up with it. So then that's by definition not cultural appropriation, because it is the cultures that are making the decision. But they're also making it not just completely independently. You're putting people together and saying, you need to make, you know, this is about a consensus process and you guys come up with a decision here. So I think that would allow things to manifest in a whole variety of different ways.
And I guess just in general, under the broader umbrella of psychedelic research, like, what are you personally the most excited about right now?
Well, the fact that it's happening. You know, I've been involved with drug policy reform for many decades. And when I first started, I never thought cannabis would be legalized in my lifetime. And I really thought that, you know, I was talking to people who would make this thing happen long after my demise. But it actually is happening in my lifetime. And I think that's wonderful. Yeah. I think that we haven't seen the pharmaceutical companies derailing anything. I think they have an agenda to do so, but they aren't. So they're not doing a counter propaganda thing against us, which there was speculation that they would, because people will take less drugs when they take psychedelics, you know, and so we get people off of mental health medications. So I'm thrilled that it seems to be, the public discussion seems to be evidence-based, which is, from my perspective, quite remarkable.
Great, okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate this.
You're welcome, my pleasure. Thank you for your interest in this important topic.
Hello, everyone. This is Sara from the Arts Report here on CITR, and it is Fun Drive Week here. This week is the one time each year we ask for your support to help us keep local and help keep independent and alternative voices on the air. CITR has given me and others here at the Arts Report so many opportunities that we're eternally grateful for. We get to meet local artists, interview them, and do reviews on shows that we never thought we'd be able to see, and we do it thanks to your donations. So, if you're in a position to contribute, please visit citr.ca/donate in order to donate. No donation is too little, and thank you so much.
And welcome back to On The Point by CITR 101.9 FM. This is your source for alternative and undercover news from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. And you just heard an interview with Mark Hayden from MAPS Canada about psychedelics. Before we get to the next interview, just a reminder, this is Fun Drive season. It's our annual fundraiser here at the station. And I just wanted to emphasize how important supporting community radio like CITR is. I've been a member of the News Collective for 2 years. It's just such a great opportunity to really flex the journalism muscles here at UBC, and just get to talk to so many interesting people. Like, I've gotten to talk to people that I think would serve me in any set if I was working for an actual news organization. And the fact that, you know, we're making these stories and we're putting them out, it's just a testament to how important independent and community radio is. And you know, CITR is supported by listener donations first and foremost, and you know, you're really supporting not just local journalism, but like local music, local arts coverage, like so much more. And, you know, now more than ever, like we really, really need your support. So if you really, if you have some money spare, go over to citr.ca/donate and, you know, choose the news collective when you decide to donate. That'd be really great. So that's once again, CITR. So that's literally the letters CITR.ca/donate. All right, let's get to a subject very close to me, the farmers' protests in India.
I went to a local protest organized by the group Voices of the Oppressed in support of the farmers' protests in India. I was able to speak with Namjeet, a volunteer at the protest, about the importance of the issue and why people were motivated to come out.
So this has been in the news the world over. Rihanna, Greta Thunberg, you know, they put out tweets in support of the protests. You know, the Indian media, in typical fashion, went after them. I think the farmer protests that are happening in India right now is one of the biggest protest movements in India, you know, possibly even since independence from, you know, colonial rule 74 years ago. And, you know, as I mentioned, the international support for the protests, you know, had its fair share of problems too.
Before this protest happened, a car rally in support of the farmers was shut down by the RCMP, despite following COVID safety guidelines.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously the protest you went to was not that one, but, you know, I hope your piece just talks about, I know your piece talks about that and, like, the support for the farmers here, so, you know, let's have a listen to the piece.
On Sunday, January 24th, demonstrators gathered outside of the Vancouver Art Gallery in support of Indian farmers. The event was organized by the group Voices of the Oppressed. Hundreds of people turned out on the cold, rainy day to support farmers. Signs in front of the gallery read, "Social Justice Now," "Smash Fascism," "Climate Leaders Don't Build Pipelines," and "I Stand with the Farmers of Punjab." A few yards away, a very different event was happening. One of the anti-mask rallies that have been occurring semi-regularly in front of the art gallery since the fall. Their signs read, "Hugs over masks, stand against COVID tyranny, and no new normal." While Voices of the Oppressed had directed the participants of the protest or farmers to wear masks and practice social distancing, the anti-maskers were not doing the same, as you might expect. To protect people and enforce social distancing, organizers of the farmers' protests had volunteers hold a rope around the gathering in a wide circle. At the protest, I was able to speak to a volunteer, Namjeet, about the importance of the issue and why everyone was motivated to come and support the farmers. The people at the anti-mask rally nearby were talking into a loudspeaker, so there is some background noise. Let's take a listen.
My name is Navjeet, and I'm just an assistant to the organizer. I'm just trying to help out and give her support. I don't have a specific role, but I'm just here to show support for the farmers and for the situation in Punjab. We're all out here today because it's the human rights issues in India. Basically, the government of India has passed three laws, and they're called three black laws because they passed the laws in parliament without the due parliamentary process. So they were passed without without any sort of discussion with the farmers, and they were also passed forcefully in parliament during COVID to take advantage of the farmers, and so maybe they wouldn't notice. But these laws basically are death warrant for the farmers in Punjab. So most of us are here because our roots are Punjab. We may live in Canada, we were born in Canada, but our roots, our parents, our grandparents are all from Punjab, and that's our roots. So that's why we're here, to show support. It's a human rights issue, and at the end of the day, it affects all of us. It doesn't just affect the farmers in Punjab, because they feed, not only do they feed the country of India, but they feed the world. So we all need to come out and show support for the farmers. The rally was going to start at 1 o'clock, so it's slowly more and more people are showing up, but we're hoping for hundreds to show up today in support, and from all different communities and all different ethnicities and all different races, because globally there's human rights issues in all cultures. So it's good if we all come together as one and show support for each other. Yes.
I do notice that there seems to be an anti-mask event happening over there. Do you expect any issues with them?
I'm not too aware. I just got here a little while ago, so I'm not so sure, but I've heard there's a little bit of conflict. But we have security, and I think everything's under control. And I guess they have their right to protest, and we have ours, and they have a different issue, and we have a different issue. But at the end of the day, we should have respect for each other, and we should not be having any acts of violence or any type of aggression, because everybody has a right to protest. Yes.
Great. Basically, does the pandemic have an impact on what you're protesting here today?
Well, the pandemic does have a role in this, in these black laws getting passed, because the government took advantage of the situation that India, most of India was in a lockdown when the bills were passed in Parliament in June. So they took advantage of the situation that people are in lockdown, they're not going to protest, they're not going to come to the streets because they're going to be scared of COVID. But at the end of the day, their livelihood, their life is their land. So they're not scared of COVID or a global pandemic. For them, if they lose their land, they lose their life. It's a death warrant. So they're fearless. They're out on the streets for 50 days and they're not worried. They're not wearing masks and they're not doing their hand sanitizing and they don't have clean water. But that COVID is secondary for them. The land is first for the Punjabi people. That's their mother. Mother Earth is their life. And they feel like that their life is being taken away from them. Yeah. So they're not worried about COVID. Yeah.
And what are your goals for this event today? Are you asking if the Canadian government to do something, or are you just trying to raise awareness?
I think it's at multiple levels, but the first thing is to educate and bring awareness to the general population, not just in Lower Mainland, but also within British Columbia and in Canada. And then next is to bring awareness around the world, that everybody should know what's happening in India. The global news is not getting out around the world because the government of India has blocked the national media. So there's many people around the world that they don't even know that this is happening in Punjab. So what is our duty? Our duty is to come to these protests and rallies and bring awareness to around the world and use our power of our social media to spread the message of the farmers. Yes, because they're being blocked. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Hello there, this is Sabrina from CPOV Connection. This week is Fun Drive here at CITR, the one time each year where we ask for your support to help us keep local, independent, and alternative voices on the air. Personally, CITR has been an amazing platform to not only express my love and passion in music, but most importantly, to share my culture and identity with our community here and to celebrate cultural diversity together. What I absolutely love about CITR is that the community welcomes people from all different backgrounds and provides a safe space for voices that commercial media does not. If you are in a position to contribute, please visit citr.ca/donate to donate. Thank you.
Welcome back to On the Point by CITR 101.9 FM, your source of alternative and undercover news from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. You just heard an interview with Manjeet, a volunteer with the protest at the Art Gallery at the end of January.
So, on to headlines. The NPA, which is Vancouver's center-right party, has been in the news a lot lately. And so today they have sued the City of Vancouver and Mayor Kennedy Stewart for defamation, saying the attack is false and partisan, with a deliberate attempt to attack the character of each and all NPA board members for political gain. So, what do you guys think is going to happen?
Yeah, and the attack they're referring to, by the way, it's something I think we talked about. If we haven't, it's a tweet that Kennedy Stewart put out saying that there's extremism within the party and there are links to hate groups. I think both of which are true, as documented in a TIE article by Melanie Green. You know, there's members of the NPA board like making the OK symbol, which is, you know, symbol that's been co-opted by white supremacists. And, you know, people wearing Make America Great Again hats, which I don't need to tell you what exactly they stand for. So I don't know whether this suit is going to succeed. I'm not a lawyer, but this is my purely, like, my hypothesis is this is just a suit to sort of save face by this NPA board. Because you got to remember that this is a board that seems at odds with the elected members of its party, like Melissa DeGenova and, you know, Sarah Kabiyang and all the elected members of the party. They have been calling for this board to be voted out, essentially. And, you know, the election is next year. City of Vancouver election is next year. So all of this drama happening like 1 year before it's supposed to go to the polls is pretty interesting, right? So yeah, I don't think this defamation suit is gonna succeed in any way. Like, they also named the city of Vancouver as a co-defendant, which is a choice, I guess. So I think it's just a move to sort of buff themselves up ahead of all of the turmoil that's sort of happening. You know, they might be voted out of the NPA board pretty soon. And, you know, like, one of the directors of the NPA was, like, recently saying he's going to go to Florida to watch the Super Bowl and whatever. So, like, you know, that party just seems like they're having a lot of problems right now.
Yeah, I think this suit has a good chance of not winning. From what I understand about defamation law, if it can be proved true in any way, they don't really have a case.
Yeah, and there was a similar thing where they were threatening to sue the Tai for, you know, writing the article about the MAGA hats and stuff. And, like, they were threatening to sue the Tai for defamation too. And, like, that was also never going to succeed. Like, that would get laughed out of court. So, you know, it's a whole thing. It really is.
Yeah, and this reminds me of when Rebecca Bly, like, went independent, I think, a few years ago, that we covered, actually, on the News Collective, and just seeing the board. I mean, it was already kind of, like, a right party, but now it's, like, even more extremist, it feels.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think the distinction, it's a fallacious distinction to draw, but you know, some people like to draw the distinction between the way Donald Trump led the Republican Party versus the Republican Party just before Donald Trump, right? Sort of respectable conservative, if that such a thing exists. I don't believe it does, because as I've talked about on the show in the past, if you are supposedly socially left but fiscally right, you are actually just both right-wing, because if you don't pass the policies that allow underrepresented people to get representation, then how can you claim to be socially left? Anyway, so that is sort of the character of the elected members of the party. They're respectable conservative, quote-unquote, even though they've said some pretty nasty stuff, whatever. But, you know. But yeah, certainly the board is far more abrasive about the way in which they show their politics. And that doesn't seem to be sitting right with the elected members of the party. So, you know, that's, it's going to be, a lot of things might change between now and next year's election. We're going to have to see. Certainly, I mean, it's obvious that Mayor Kennedy Stewart put out this statement for some sort of political gain. He wouldn't have used the City of Vancouver masthead without some level of knowledge about what that carries. But nonetheless, I don't think that was defamatory in any way. Most of it, I think, is either an opinion or is true. So we're going to have to see. I think the courts probably will agree with me, but, you know, who knows? Weirder things have happened. Right. On the topic of weird things, let's talk about our station and let's talk about fundraising. So, I'm going to let Grace do most of the talking here, but Grace, can you talk about fundraising with CITR and, you know, your relationship with the station, and why do you think it's so important to, you know, donate?
Yeah, so I started with CITR back in September, and it's been a great opportunity to get some experience with journalism and reporting and audio editing, and I think it's just I think community radio is just a great thing to invest in.
Absolutely. And if you invest this time around, you can get some pretty cool stuff. So what can you get if you invest into our station?
Yeah, you can get, for $5 a month, you can get a customized CITR and Discorder fun-dried candy hearts and a woven patch. For a bit more, you can get some cozy socks. For $15 a month, you can get a CITR tea towel and on-air song dedication. For $25 a month, you can get a framed cover of Discorder magazine.
And for $50 a month, you can host a show on CITR. And you get recognition on our donor wall, in addition to all of the rest of those awesome items.
Yes, and all of the rewards that Grace was mentioning, they're all cumulative. So, like, if you put in $15 a month, you get, you get the woven patch, you get the socks, you get everything. So, like, it's just such a good deal. I don't know why you're not jumping on this opportunity right now. So, where can they donate, Grace?
They can donate at citr.ca/donate and choose the News Collective to let them know that we sent you.
Fantastic. So yes, that's once again, that's citr.ca/donate. I mean, I don't want to spell out donate, but just go there as little as you can and as much as you can. And, it just helps keep us going. And, it's just a good way to show your support for all sorts of really cool stuff. So, yeah.
Coolio. So that's our show for today. Another reminder right at the end to donate to our annual fundraiser, Fund Drive. Seriously, try and support local music, local news, and local arts coverage by going to citr.ca/donate and putting the News Collective as the reason you donated. We'll be back next Saturday at 7 p.m. for more local news. Stay tuned for more great CITR programming.